Republicans to wake up is the Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live.
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Thank you for joining me today for another edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. It's supported by listeners coast to coast, and I have proof. Del Leonard subscribes from Maine. Susan Gavet from right here in California. You can do it too. Log on to peterbcollins.com. And our bonus book offer continues for people who sign up for an annual subscription for a mere $50. Before the end of this podcast, we catch up on a couple of dispatches. Gary Chu's review of the new Will Ferrell flick, Campaign. And Will Durst comments on the selection of Paul Ryan in what passes for a real campaign in America this year. But our headliner today rejoins us by Skype from his easy chair somewhere inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. Thomas Frank writes the Easy Chair lead essay in Harper's Magazine every month. He is the author of another important book called Pity the Billionaire, which has been translated into Deutsch. And he is on his way to Deutschland to plug the book and suffer slings and arrows from German commentators. He also is proud that his Harper's columns are now available at his own personal website, tcfrank.com. And should we plug the Baffler too, Tom?
Well, I don't see why not, Peter B.
Yeah.
Let me tell you about it.
Yeah, so tell people about the Baffler. You have two editions this year.
Literary magazine that I started. Get this, Peter B. Collins. I started it in 1988.
Holy cow. That was in the last century.
Yeah.
Before the Y2K meltdown.
It was before the personal computer. It developed a kind of a reputation for a certain critical style. And now it's being edited by John Summers and published in Boston, Massachusetts. And I still write for it, but I'm not in charge anymore. But I wrote a couple pretty good essays for it. I'm writing another one right now. I'm working on it right now.
Uh-huh. Who said they were pretty good?
I think they're pretty good. I mean, that's my own opinion, you know.
Well, it is important that you like your work.
Yeah, it is. And you know, you have a lot of writers on your show, and so you know this, that if you ask them at different times, they're going to tell you that they hate their work.
Right.
Or that they are, you know, when I'm writing something, I'm trying to do my best, right?
Usually they hate the covers of their books that were foisted on them by the art department at the publisher.
Yeah.
I hear that a lot.
That's never been a big problem for me, mm-hmm. But what will happen is I'll write something, I'll work on it, I'll get it to this point where I'm really pleased with it, you know, and then it comes out in the magazine. And by the way, and I have a lot to be thankful for that I am in a position to do that. You know, a lot of writers aren't. They turn something in and the editors hack it apart and that's it. But I'm able to oversee the quality right up to the last minute, and it comes out, it's printed, it's published, and then I read it and I'm like, what was I thinking? This is just such trash.
Aww.
Okay, I always have this reaction. I always have the same reaction. And then a couple days later, I'll pick it up again, and I'll think, this is awesome.
Yeah.
So I go back and forth on my own work. I alternately love it and I hate it, and I get the cycle. You know, and the cycle is very predictable. It comes and goes. But right now, I think those Baffler stories were pretty good. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty happy with them. There was a time, if you'd asked me a couple of weeks ago, I would have been like, yeah, forget it. Sorry, I did it.
And you had a vacation that you are still relaxed from a month later.
I'm still relaxed. Yes, I know. I don't know what's going on. I mean, I've got to get my anger back. But yeah, I went on vacation to Oregon.
Oh, nice.
And Washington State. I was out there in the Pacific Northwest.
Oh, great. Well, we're glad you came to the Left Coast. And I wanted to get you to expand a little bit about your Easy Chair column this month and also the posture of Harper's Magazine, because the cover has a halftone artist rendering of Barack Obama. Under it, it reads, "Nowhere Man, Obama in the Desert of Centrism," by you, Thomas Frank. And then part two, "The Content of His Character," a lengthy and interesting essay by David Samuels. And the tone of it is that Harper's Magazine has kind of arrived where I've been for a while, which is deeply doubtful about Barack Obama and really only able to support him because of the bleak alternatives. And you did a good job in Pity the Billionaire, which was primarily focused on what you call the hard time swindle and the propaganda of the Republicans. But you didn't give Obama a pass in the book, and we talked about that at the time. So it's not like you're Tommy come lately to criticizing Obama.
It's more than that. I went back and I've written another essay for Harper's, by the way, reviewing the sort of enthusiasm that people felt about Obama back in 2008, which was kind of an interesting phenomenon, especially considering what then came to pass. Mm-hmm. Right. And so I went back and was reviewing a lot of that that feeling for him. And I thought, well, the only fair way to do this is to criticize my own writing at the time. And I went back and read it, and I was I never wrote or I could not find, you know, I was a columnist for the Wall Street Journal at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I never really got into the Obama feeling. I mean, I voted for him, I was that when I went down to the National Mall the day before he was sworn in. I didn't want to go down the day of the inauguration because there was a million people down there. But I went down the day before, and it was really something else. I never did. I never got that feeling into my own writing, though.
Mm-hmm.
So I am. You know, I can now say I never really fell for the Obama magic. But I don't know. I'm such a cynical person. Maybe I'll fall for it this time around.
you know,
this time around, I'm really into him or something.
Tom, for me, the real kind of reality check came at the acceptance speech at the stadium in Denver. And I was up in a skybox with a bunch of other liberal radio hosts, and they were all cheering. And there were a couple of points that he made. It was there where he unloaded the Afghanistan commentary and saying that was the right war and he was basically going to finish it. And he had us at that point. All right, we're in this stadium. He's just been crowned the nominee. They had a rather dramatic set that they had brought in with these Greek columns, or maybe they were Roman. I don't know.
I remember that, yes.
And you know, I felt the fervor in the stadium, and I didn't feel it myself. And it was because I felt, well, okay, this is an improvement. It's going to be better than Bush. He, you know, certainly is head and shoulders above McCain and Palin. But I at that point, kind of realized that he had successfully given Americans a blank canvas on which we could project our aspirations.
Yeah.
And it worked. And the hope,
and that's, by the way, that's what he knows. That's what he does. That's what he says that he does.
Yeah.
He, that was in the Audacity of Hope. So, you know, by the way, I liked that speech. I remember that speech really well. That was one of his, in my mind, that was one of his best moments. The speech that everybody thought was so wonderful, though, was the one, you remember in 2004 at the Democratic Convention in 2004,
yeah.
His
yeah.
speech where there's no red America, there's no blue America, there's just the United States of America. I thought that left me cold. And I knew mm-hmm. who he was at the time, and I was very proud, you know, because I had been living in Chicago. I'd
right.
been a constituent of his up until very recently, and I was very proud to see him be there, you know, the keynote speaker at the convention. And then I thought that speech was just so lame and trite. And that was his great moment. I've never really got that. But I get it now. I get it now, because Democrats, by and large, the kind of Democrats that that run the Democratic Party and that live here in Washington, D.C. and that go to the convention, they have a kind of you know, they don't really have an ideology in the sense that they have a you know, a political philosophy that they want to see, in the sense that the right has an ideology, you know, the free market, all that sort of thing. They don't have that. What they do have, though, is this love of bipartisanship. That is what they are all about. That is what being a Democrat in Washington, D.C. in the year 2008, that's what it was. It was having this great faith in bipartisanship and everybody holding hands and doing everything together. Or in 2004, and he totally appealed to that. And he appealed. If you go back and read his memoirs, he's written two memoirs, and he'll probably write a third after. I mean, of course he will after he gets done being president. But I went back and read them. You know, The Audacity of Hope and Dreams from My Father. Mm-hmm. And Dreams from My Father is a pretty good book, although highly predictable. And, you know, part of this genre that everybody and his brother was producing back in those days. And, I mean, it's more successful than 99% of those. But The Audacity of Hope is just your straight-up Democrats, you know, hymn to bipartisanship. That's what the book is about. The only thing we learn from it is that Barack Obama is intellectually committed to centrism in a way that other people aren't. You know, other people do it, you know, to gain a partisan advantage or to win a fight or, mm-hmm. you know, for some sort of practical reason. He's committed to it in a much deeper way. You know, philosophically, he's a believer in it. And that was
so he's a post-partisan ideologue?
Yeah, exactly. Isn't that funny? I mean, the way when you put it like that, yeah, exactly. That is his ideology. And so he gets into office and, you know, makes this amazing sort of series of blunders, all of them due to this faith that the Republicans can be bargained with. I mean, think about the things that are the biggest mistakes of his presidency. The first one, Tim Geithner as Secretary of the Treasury.
Yeah.
The dude's a Republican.
Yeah.
Did you know this, Peter B?
You know, I didn't know he was a registered Republican, but I've always thought he identifies as one.
He had to become independent in order to join the administration.
Uh-huh. Now, I had forgotten about that. You know, I was distracted by Gates as the key Republican holdover.
Yeah, well, he's not a holdover. He brought him over from the, you know, from the Federal Reserve. He was the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, but he was a Republican.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, Ben Bernanke, Republican.
Yeah.
And Judd
Gregg, remember, he tried to appoint the senator from New Hampshire, and Gregg said no.
Yeah, that was kind of a tactical maneuver to try to get the 60th vote in the Senate, I believe. But then he all the sort of conciliatory moves that he made on like the stimulus, where he frittered away, geez, a third of it on worthless tax cuts,
mm-hmm.
In order to mollify some Republicans.
Who never voted for it.
I think, you know, he did get them to vote for it. But the fact is he got one or two votes or something like that.
Yeah, it wasn't much.
He was a brand new president, elected with this overwhelming popular support in a time of national emergency. He could have had whatever he wanted, and he should have insisted on it. Mm-hmm. He should have picked a fight with them right away and knock them down. And he also should have done away with the filibuster. I mean, let's be frank here. He could have wiped out the idea of the filibuster and had whatever he wanted. And the filibuster is profoundly undemocratic. He should have done it anyways,
mm-hmm.
you know? And just yesterday, by the way, in yesterday's New York Times is another example of this. There's a measure called cram down that everybody was calling for. It's when you go bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
The judge can modify the terms of a mortgage that you hold. And this had been, I think, had been made illegal in the Bush era bankruptcy bill.
Right.
And lots of Democrats wanted to bring it back. Obama wanted to bring it back, but he wouldn't get behind it and wouldn't push for it. And so they didn't, because he said this, and this is was in, according to the New York Times yesterday, because he wanted to mollify the Republicans on an important point. But you go down the list.
And let me add another one that is fresh. The New York Times over this past weekend published an analysis of his judicial appointments. He's been much slower than Bush was to put his people on the courts, and he has been unwilling to risk political capital on truly liberal or progressive nominees, not only at the Supreme Court, but all the way down appeals and district court level. And we have still, I've got the chart right here, a stunning imbalance. For example, on the appeals court in St. Louis, 82% of the judges are Republican appointees. New Orleans, 59%. Cincinnati, 63%. Chicago, 64%. And he has not rectified the court packing of the previous administrations and also with the U.S. attorneys. He didn't clean out the U.S. attorneys, which is his prerogative, and we were left with a lot of these holdovers.
And the source of one of the worst scandals of the Bush years, of course, the U.S. attorneys. The two examples that really took my breath away were the fighting over health care reform, where he negotiated with the Republicans for months. It dragged on. Do you remember that? On and on, conceding one point after another in order to get their votes. He got none.
He was actually negotiating with himself much of that time, Tom.
yeah. But he says in The Audacity of Hope that it's not fair to start from a 100% position and make the other team bargain you down. That's not fair. That's not the right way to do it. That's not true bipartisanship.
And who's this the new Tea Party nominee from Indiana who's defeated Richard Lugar, Blackstone,
yes,
or
I'll think Murdoch.
Murdoch, yeah, with a U, M-O-U-R, Doc. Anyway, he says that the way to he likes the cram down. He believes that the way to deal with Democrats is that when they adopt his position. That's a negotiation.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's what Bush used to say also, or Tom DeLay. That's their idea of bipartisanship. And then the worst example, and I know I'm just there's no reason to go over Barack Obama's greatest failures here, except for that it's, we are reviewing his career as president. The worst one was when he gave the Republicans he talked his Democrats. Remember, they'd taken their shellacking in 2010, the midterm shellacking, but there was a lame duck session, and the Bush tax cuts were going to expire. He talked them into renewing them
for 2 years, so they would come up this year. Brilliant!
In exchange for almost nothing. In exchange for almost nothing, right?
You got 26 weeks of unemployment benefits.
Months later, of course, you have the huge showdown over the debt ceiling, something that had never been used as a political weapon before, and now they're going to hold the nation's credit rating hostage, possibly cause a ruinous financial crisis, and he's got nothing. He's got no weapon to challenge them with because he gave it away in the spirit of bipartisanship. This guy is really bad at the game.
Now, let's take
now,
that. Let's
two,
take
two but, takeaways from this.
Okay,
sorry,
but
you
I
go first.
All right, and we'll get to your takeaways. I'll write down takeaways. But
forget that. I should never use that kind of cliche, and I apologize.
Okay, you already said let's be frank, and I just want to be on record that you used it, not me. But this year, I do give Obama credit because in his campaign rhetoric and in the vote that Harry Reid forced. On extending the tax cuts for all except the top 2%, they have set a much clearer line of demarcation between Democrats and Republicans, forced Republicans to take stands in favor of continuing the tax cuts for the uber rich. And I think that that is the right way to frame this. And still, it's going to come down to a lame duck session, and I'm not very optimistic that these pre-election positions will hold.
Yes, I think that's probably right. He's playing the game differently today. He's wised up. Barack Obama has wised up a great deal, but it's too late. I mean, the bird has flown. You know what I'm saying? There's two really interesting things about all this. And the first is that even though this man is born to conciliate. He is a born conciliator. That's what The Audacity of Hope is all about. That's what his famous speech in 2004 was all about. That's what he's done as president. What is it that the Republicans call him? A socialist.
A Muslim.
An extremist.
Un-American. Hank Williams Jr.
Far left, crazy leftist, left-wing administration filled with nuts.
Yeah.
He's
been more accommodating to business interests than almost any recent president. And, I want to talk in a minute about Cass Sunstein, because he recently left the White House, and he was corporate America's fixer. He yeah. watered down every piece of legislation or policy that came through there.
He was in the Reagan administration, you know.
I didn't recall that, no.
Yeah. It was a minor position, but, you know, he I admire Cass Sunstein for some of his academic work, but that's exactly right. That was his role in the administration, is he was the go-to guy. But
it's interesting, if you Google Cass Sunstein and his departure from the White House, these business publications, Business Week and Forbes, they say, we lost our best friend in the White House.
yeah, that's right. But if you look at what the Republicans in Congress said about it, you know, it's like, oh, the socialist. But here's the thing, is that, okay, what the Republicans are doing now is giving Barack Obama this kind of lesson in basic game theory, which is that if the relationship of the two parties – is that your dog, Peter B. Collins?
Yes, and there's somebody –
Is that one of your secret radio sound effects?
Right, that's my dog, Chloe. She's acknowledging someone at the door right now.
okay. The, you know, look, basic game theory, if you've got two sides playing this game and one side says, okay, I'm going to I'm going to be like extremely conciliatory and I'm going to, you know, seek bipartisanship and seek consensus. This is my son, Teddy here, and do all these wonderful things. And you write a book about it and you announce it and you let the world know that that's how you're going to rule. Well, the other side in this game that we're playing, the other side is going to obviously choose to be the ones who never give an inch and who force you to come to them, you know, because that's the position that over in the long term, that's the position that gets what it wants, mm-hmm. you know? And what's more is if you define everything in this kind of relativistic sense where it's about the two parties, it's not about the issues. It's not about like doing something that Franklin Roosevelt did, or it's not about, you know, this issue or that. It's about where the two parties stand. Where does red America stand? Where does blue America stand? Then the right can just move as far to the right as they want because it's all about the distance between the two parties. And they can just say, well, it's not us that's moving. It's them. Look how far apart we are. You know, it takes two to tango. It's very easy once you walk down that road to relativism, it's very easy to get played this way. And he is getting an incredible, you know, real world lesson in the folly of this way of governing, this way of ruling.
And why did it take him so long to figure it out? The Republicans were not ambiguous in any way. They were very clear and public.
Come here
about
to Washington, see, there is an enormous industry. It's not an enormous industry. It's the Democratic Party. It's the mainstream of the Democratic Party, and they believe in this stuff. They believe in conciliation. Look, they don't really like being Democrats. You know, we have two parties in this country. You know, and somebody's got to be in the other party. You know, the Republicans have this very clear-cut mission. They're the party of business. They're the party of you know, whatever you want to say, of traditional values. Though they aren't really. They're the party of business. Okay, who's the other team? The party of labor? No, they don't want to be that. There's no money in that. You understand? These people live like just as princely a manner as Republicans do, you know. They have their lobbyists too. They have their whole apparatus to support, and they live in the same suburbs, and they have swimming pools that are just as large, and they want to retire to the same, you know, resorts. What are they going to do? Well, there's no percentage in being the party of labor, being the party of poor people. They don't want to be that. And so, you know, it's very fortunate that all of them have managed to see the light, right, and become what they call new Democrats, right? They know all about how awesome free trade is and how labor unions are a thing of the past and how, you know, that we have to unleash the entrepreneurial genius of it. You know, look, read a guy like Tom Friedman. That's the kind of Democrats that rule this city. That's mm-hmm. in Washington, D.C., everything Barack Obama has been hailed as this genius. They love him.
And
he's like Bill
E.J. Dionne is seen as a dangerous lefty, and he's right down the middle of the road.
E.J. is actually a friend of mine, and that is exactly right. E.J. is he demarcates the left end of the respectable. I used to say that I did that until I realized that Democrats, when I used to write for the Wall Street Journal, that I was the partisan – or not partisan, the pundit, you know, on the left. I was him. Mm-hmm. But – they just didn't read me. They just tuned me right out.
Right.
But they do read. They read E.J. Dionne. You know, he's an important guy in this town.
Yeah.
But he's the left end of respectable opinion in this city.
And he is not that far left.
No, in the grand scheme of things, no, not really. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, he's honest and
really thoughtful guy.
Yeah,
I like
he's
him.
He's honest and a good analyst. But he's not an advocate for any progressive positions that, as you say, go beyond the respectable.
Yeah, that's right.
And that, I think, does explain the zeitgeist.
Tom Friedman is the sort of ideal Democrat in this town. It would be hard to find a single issue where he could be called a liberal. But he is, nominally, he's one of the liberal commentators in the New York Times. And that's the kind of Democrat that they're comfortable with here. That's the kind of Democrat that gets funded. And funding is a huge part of it. You can go around the city. There's all these think tanks, all these partisan organizations. There are Republican ones. I was going to say there are some on the left and some on the right, but there aren't really on the left. There aren't any. I mean, there's maybe Center for American Progress, which does have some people in it who are on the left.
Yeah,
but by and large, the
Think Progress blog has done some good work in pushing the Democratic Party leftward. I'll put it
that
way.
But by and large, the money in this town is all on these groups that identify. They always have the word new in their name, or something about the third way or something like this. It's always about, like, you know, that nobody wants to be, you know, like Harry Truman Democrats. Nobody wants to be that.
Well,
that is what you cannot be in this burg. And so you constantly have to reassure people that you're not that. You know,
let me ask you for your thoughts about this, because about a month ago, President Obama flew into Oakland, California, and he had a low level fundraiser where you could get in for $100. And then he had the $36,000 thing at a home in the hills. And the low end fundraiser was at the Fox Theater. It's in the heart of Oakland, which is the most poverty-stricken zone in California. He didn't mention poverty. He was two blocks away from Oaksterdam, where his pledge to basically take no action to shut down marijuana dispensaries in California it has been proven false. And he came in after one round of gun violence into the city with the highest murder rate per capita in California. And he didn't mention any of those issues. And the Times Magazine over the weekend took us back to Roseland, the decrepit part of Chicago, where his work as a community organizer first began.
Oh, yeah.
And so, you know, these important things that he could be talking about are completely ignored as he serves up bromides about the economy and how, you know, he's got better ideas than Romney. No disagreement there. But he stays with very safe issues, never talks about Afghanistan, never talks about the creeping police state and the wiretapping that's now legalized. And
yep,
and so
right.
the omissions of what he talks about and then the very narrow focus of his rhetoric are things that most people don't seem to notice, but they really stand out to me.
All right. I'm going to make you really depressed here, Peter B. When he came into office in 09, I knew that he was a centrist at heart, and that's who he was. But it didn't really matter. The economy was in such a dire state, you know, and things were the country was, you know, was circling the drain. You'd open up the newspaper every morning, there'd be another shocking headline. I mean, I'll never forget picking up the newspaper in the morning as General Motors declares bankruptcy. You know, that's a terrifying moment. And you had, of course, the Wall Street collapse, the unemployment spiking, the economy is falling apart. And I thought when he came in, okay, so he's a centrist, so that's what he's always been, you know. He writes these books about it and how wise it is. It doesn't matter. Events are going to force his hand. He is going to – if he wants to solve the economic problems, he's going to have to be Franklin Roosevelt. You know, he's going to have to brush the Republicans aside because they're not going to cooperate with him. Or maybe he'll get a couple of them who will. Either way, he's going to have to take, you know, decisive action. He's going to have to strike out in a new direction for this country. And the sort of, you know, Clinton era you know, Clinton era triangulation is not going to cut it. I don't just mean like, you know, balancing in between the parties. I mean, you know, deregulating Wall Street, which Clinton did, you know, deregulating this, deregulating that, let organized labor go to hell. All those things that Clinton did, that's not going to work. He's going to have to do completely new things. You know, if he wants the economy to recover, he's going to have to, you know, step up and do battle with Wall Street. He's probably going to have to break up the banks. He's certainly going to have to re-regulate them. If he wants unemployment to go down, he's going to have to do something like the WPA. He's going to have direct federal employment. He's going to have to spend tons and tons of money. And he's going to have to make the case for spending tons and tons of money. He can't just do it and not talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
But you go on down the list, all the things that I thought he was going to be forced to do.
Right.
He didn't do any of them.
Yeah.
Or if he did, you know, he did them very half-heartedly.
Well, we bought Citigroup. We just didn't take ownership.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And we're on the hook. The banks are bigger. There's fewer of them. I mean, the Wall Street banks, they're bigger than ever.
Right.
And they've got a little asterisk by their symbol. This company will get bailed out if they ever screw it up again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's unbelievable. And he's allowed that situation to continue. And I thought that's folly of the first order. But the centrism is more important to him than actually solving this country's problems. The centrism was more important. And that, when you think about that, that is astonishing. Okay. What kind of, I mean, how does this, and I called it an ideology earlier, and I think it is. How does it have that kind of power over the mind of someone? And by the way, and I've met Barack Obama, a very intelligent man.
Mm-hmm.
He's not no George Bush, you know, he's a highly, you know, he was a professor at the University of Chicago, for Pete's sake.
Right.
How is it possible that a man like that is unable to see what needs to be done and instead is prisoner to this, you know, to this ideology of centrism?
Let me stop you right there and ask you to answer that question, because my far left friends say, well, right after he was elected, they sat him down and they told him all these national security secrets. And he's now into the black world. That's not a racial comment. And he suddenly has to change his positions. And sure, he went forward with the plan publicly to close Guantanamo, but didn't push back when even members of his own party insisted that it remain open. Trying Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in New York.
That's a conspiracy theory. Come on now.
No, I understand. I'm offering that as what some people circulate, and I'm asking you to answer your own question. What happened to change the professor?
I think that it has an ideological power over these over certain Democrats in the same way that, look, we're living in an ideological age. Pity the Billionaire was about the ideology, largely the ideology of Republicans, the conservative movement. And these are people who believe something that's similarly disastrous and similarly unconnected to reality, the stuff about the free market, you know, and that we just didn't go far enough. We didn't deregulate far enough. Oh, my God, Peter B., look at Paul Ryan. Read the preamble to his roadmap to America's future sometime. That's what he says. It's like he's cribbing Pity the Billionaire in his roadmap. You know, I wish I had. I mean, I didn't read that until the day that Mitt Romney chose him.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what he says. We, you know, we've got this huge interlocking government and business interlocking at every level, and we have to take this sucker apart. We have to get back to free markets in the 19th century sense. He doesn't say that, of course, but that's what he means. And it is the faith of the right, you know, that and this is what they're putting forward in answer to a collapse brought on by deregulation of Wall Street. They're like, no, we just didn't go far enough.
Mm.
And it's incredible to me because it's so divorced from reality. And I think that the ideology of the Democrats is similarly divorced from reality, that they can't imagine that what worked for Clinton wouldn't work in any and every situation. I mean, Clinton is this sort of mystical figure for these guys, you know, that what is starts as a good tactical maneuver, you know, for Clinton. Remember the Democratic Leadership Council? It all started as a kind of tactical maneuver to beat the Republicans and outmaneuver the left flank of the Democratic Party. They wanted to get those guys out. And so they're like, well, you have to do this. You have to do that. And it started as that. And it's become a kind of faith for these people. it's something that is impervious to and this is another really striking thing about the Obama era. It's impervious to dispute, to being questioned by the outside world, by people like you and me. When I was writing, and I wrote, just finished another Harper's essay, by the way, and turned it in, and it'll be out next month, and it's even more depressing than this one. And at one point, I was looking. You see the bookshelf behind me?
I can.
And
yes.
I was looking at these titles, all of these liberal books, a lot of them written by my friends, you know, a lot of them written by other people that I don't know, but a lot of them coming to the same point, a lot of them about the financial crisis, that you've got an oligarchy in this country. You've got a plutocracy in this country. You've got regulatory capture in this country. Remember, I wrote a book called The Wrecking Crew.
Yeah.
That's what it was about. Mm-hmm. That came out in 2008. I was on your radio show. We talked about you played music by the band Kansas or something
that's
like that.
That's right.
But that's what it was about. And today, this idea is everywhere. Okay? Everybody knows it. The Tea Party movement knows it. The Occupy movement knows it. Your average consumer of books that are bestsellers on the New York Times, bestseller list knows this. Mm-hmm. That this is true. That the interests control government through the revolving door. I mean, Jack Abramoff goes out there and says it now. It's not a secret. But the Obama administration, it just doesn't acknowledge it. It's not. They are divorced from that reality. You know why? Because they're like, well, you know, we're in the center. We're centrists. That's an idea that's – we can say that idea is, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10, that idea is like an 8. But we are 3. You know, we're at the level 3. They're at the level 8. Everything can be dismissed by this kind of geometry.
Now,
that's an idea that's too extreme.
Now, Tom –
look at who's advocating it.
On the bookshelf behind you, do you have anything by George Lakoff?
Yes, I do.
Because Lakoff does an excellent job of dismissing the notion of centrism. And he correctly points out that all of us have...
And lots of people have done this. Hey, I'm talking right now. Theo, I'm on the radio right now. Come on. Lots of guys have done this. David, my friend David Sirota has done this as well. And mm-hmm. I used to try to do it in the Wall Street Journal to blast this idea. The things they believe in are not shared by the center of the country. What is it, like NAFTA? They think of their signature things, the great signature gestures of centrism. NAFTA, bank deregulation, you know? These are colossal screw-ups, allowing Bush to invade Iraq. Oh, great. Well, you know, brilliant move, guys. Do you remember when the Democrats in Congress signed off on that one as a gesture of centrism? All three of these things were that. These were their crowning glories.
Alito and Roberts.
Hated by the country.
Rolling over for those nominations of Alito and Roberts to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. All of these are catastrophes.
Mm-hmm.
And these are also dramatically unpopular. NAFTA is incredibly unpopular. What's their other thing? I don't know. You don't live here in D.C., so you don't read the Washington Post every day. There's all of these groups that favor Social Security privatization, and they all call themselves centrist.
Yeah.
Or Democrats.
Well, we have a new trade deal underway. The Pacific Partnership, I think it's called.
Yeah. Whatever, yeah.
And it's being negotiated behind closed doors, and there's essentially a news blackout on the terms of this deal. Then it's going to pop up and be fast-tracked through the Senate.
Yeah, of course. What you see what I'm getting at? Every one of these centrist ideas is basically age-old hobby horses of the conservative movement. Right? Deregulating Wall Street, having the free trade deals. Next will be Social Security privatization. Things that the right has wanted for decades and that, you know, a little sliver of the Democratic Party agrees with them on. That's all it is. It's not things that are widely shared by the American public. I mean, the public hates NAFTA. The public loves Social Security. They're gonna cram it down their throats anyway. Anyhow, it doesn't matter. You can refute this stuff endlessly. And you know how they would brush up George Lakoff, you mentioned. I mentioned David Sirota, and mm-hmm. then I myself have made these similar arguments. How would they refute that? How would they refute that? They'd say, well, these people are on the left edge of the party. We need balance. So, you know, we need somebody on the other side. They don't refute things. They just don't listen to them because they come from – everything is dismissed in an ad hominem way.
Right.
Because it comes from people whose position you can categorize as being, you know, extreme or something like that. It has nothing to do with reality or with – I come from – my background is academia. In academia, you have to answer your critics.
Yeah.
You can't just get out of it by saying, you know, No, I don't have to answer that guy because he's a professor at a university that I don't respect.
Right.
He doesn't work that way.
Yeah. Well, Tom, some of the areas that you kind of expanded your commentary in this column are really important to me. The revelations about the so-called killer capture program and that a president has taken the authority upon himself, in particular in the Alaki case, to choose an American citizen and without any process whatsoever, have a drone go and kill him in a foreign country and the following yep. week kill his two teenage sons. And yep. this is, just one example. We have the wiretapping case.
One of them was an American citizen, too.
Yeah.
One of the kids was an American citizen.
Well, and let me just tick off a few and then get your reaction. I'm very concerned that we continue the eavesdropping, the surveillance program, and that he has used the assertion of state secrets to block any accountability for the violation of the law that took place before him. And let me just mention two others. The NDAA, the Homeland Battlefield Bill, that is, there's an injunction, a temporary injunction issued by Catherine Forrest, a New York federal court judge. And about a week ago, Justice Department lawyers stood before her and objected to making the injunction permanent, but would not in any way say that they could protect the plaintiffs in the case, including Chris Hedges, from the enforcement of this very broad and vague law. And then we have the case of Peter Van Buren at the State Department. He's about to be terminated there. He didn't even do a Bradley Manning where he violated any security regulations.
You mean this guy?
Yes. We Meant Well. He's holding up Peter Van Buren's book.
It's a fantastic book.
It is.
I used to quote it all the time.
And Tom, he is a really cool guy with a great sense of humor. I've interviewed him multiple times, and Peter Van Buren, I think, is a great American. And we have more people concerned about Pussy Riot being sent to jail in Russia for 2 years than what's going on with the rollback of our Bill of Rights in the United States. And Democrats are completely silent.
You're right, and this is one of the things that bothers me the most. And I assume it'll all get worked out in the courts. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. I mean, it's amazing to me the way the national security state is coming back after it sort of got put in a box in the 1970s,
mm-hmm.
and it's just coming right back now. And I don't know what that a Democrat is the one doing this to us is highly ironic, of course, but in some ways a Democrat is the only one who could, because if it was George Bush doing it, the New York Times would be screaming like hell.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm very frustrated, Peter. I mean, and when you talk about this is probably the issue that frustrates me the most, because I feel like that they can absolutely brush people like you and me off.
Yeah.
They don't listen to us. We've got nowhere else to go. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not even a columnist at the Wall Street Journal anymore, just with Harper's Magazine. Harper's Magazine, by the way, has traditionally been very concerned, obviously, with free speech issues, as mm-hmm. every, publication like that, New York Times, they all have been, The Nation yeah. magazine. We're deeply concerned with that stuff. And I don't know it's like we have no leverage anymore. It's like our side has no purchase on power at all anymore, except for maybe the ACLU will sue them, but those guys aren't so wonderful either. They're like, they think Citizens United is awesome.
Yeah.
they're great allies. Thanks, guys.
Well, I'm going to give them a pass on that one, because there are plenty of other people who are opposed to Citizens United and articulating that well. The ACLU has done great on the surveillance state, on the rights of prisoners at Guantanamo, and a whole range of these civil liberties issues. But the point to me is, and I have to politely reject your hope that the courts will fix these things, because they don't. We see time after time the courts offer deference to the power grab of the executive branch, and Congress does no oversight whatsoever. I recently interviewed Diane Rourke. She was on the she was a staffer on the House Intelligence Committee. She exposed the wiretapping program to Pelosi and to the guy from Florida who became CIA, Portergos, who were the two leaders on the Intelligence Committee from respective parties. And Pelosi now denies that she knew about the wiretapping program. Diane Rourke says, oh, I told her about it. I gave her a series of memos. And Rourke is a very strong critic of the failure of oversight. So Congress isn't doing its job. The courts defer to the executive. And Obama has been even more aggressive and expansive than Bush was in grabbing unilateral authority.
Yeah, it's this stuff makes me the reason this stuff makes me so depressed, Peter, is because I don't see what the answer is. I reach for one of my stock answers, which is, some kind of third party movement. But I don't know. I mean, how have we secured civil rights in the past? How have we stopped these kind of outrages in the past? Mm-hmm. And it's always been between the courts and the press. But you have to have a strong press, and we certainly don't have that anymore.
No.
I mean, it's the we also are living in these days, and there's just this fantasy that the internet has this this power to that none of this stuff matters because the internet will always get through. Mm-hmm. The internet will solve everything, and we really believe that. I mean, I just saw another example of that today. If someone it was some commentator on Yahoo. It doesn't matter. I mean, you see something if you read on the internet enough. You find someone making this kind of claim every day that the internet has made everything visible and everything is transparent and no one can hide any longer. And it's a world of perfect merit and all this sort of it's complete nonsense. But you don't have a strong press and you don't have the kind of legal challenges that you used to have. Or I mean, you may have that. But look. At the end of the day, I don't know what the political solution is because there are plenty of good people. We just need to have we need to have leverage. We need to have some power over the Democrats. And the only way that's going to happen is if we have somewhere else to go other than them. I mean, we can sit home and let Romney win. I think that would be even more catastrophic.
Yeah. No, clearly
but then
that
again, I mean You've got to have other parties in the system, and the only way to do that where it's not third parties are always spoilers unless you change the system itself, and we know how to do that. It's called fusion. That used to be legal in America, was widely practiced fusion voting. That's how the Populist Party became so big so quickly, mm-hmm. and it's illegal in most states now. You could change the laws in those states, except for the thing is that the two parties don't want to change those laws.
No, because we're passing voter ID laws that are completely unnecessary.
Yeah, they're going in the opposite direction these days.
Yeah, we don't want to expand voting opportunities, including to additional parties. The whole thing is about locking down the voting universe to preserve incumbents and Republican majorities.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And they're not about to, allow robust third party movements to get going again.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the way to have pressure on the Democrats. Are there any free speech Republicans left anymore, or is that just something that's completely gone?
Can't think of any.
You got libertarians.
Right. Ron Paul is the only one who surfaces.
That's right. Of course. I'm sorry. What was I thinking? Of course, Ron Paul.
But He routinely, when he stands up for issues where I agree with him, there are no more than two other Republicans, Walter Jones from South Carolina.
Yeah.
And there's one other who has an occasional attack of conscience. I can't think of him right now.
But Kucinich is gone now.
Right.
I don't know. This is something where I don't like to write about it because it's so frustrating to me because I don't see a practical way to force the Democrats. On everything else, I can figure out how to do it, mm-hmm. How to force them this way and that. But on this particular question, if they can blow off the courts, then I don't know what the answer is, and it's really disheartening to me. So I'm trying to get you to change the subject here. I mean, I'm as outraged about it as you are. It makes me so angry.
Well, I encourage you. I know you're still feeling the wonderful effects of your vacation, but when you get back into
you're wrecking it right now, Peter B.
Well, I'm part of the wrecking crew. When you get back into the anger zone, I hope you'll work on this because these are important issues and. we can't be sloughed off. Let me give you an example. At the Denver convention, I interviewed Michael Yockey. He's a former chief of staff to Nancy Pelosi, and I've known him for many years. She installed him as the head of the platform committee, and he gleefully announced that the FISA reform law had been passed in early August, and it locked in the illegal actions that had preceded it, right? It legalized the warrantless wiretapping in a massive way. And I said, I really object to that. And he just smiled and he said, well, we've taken the issue off the table for November. And I said, Michael, you can't take my Fourth Amendment rights off the table just for an election. We're not going to get them back. And since then, I've seen Pelosi, and I really annoyed her because we were making a little chit-chat, and it was clear she was ready to wrap it up. I said, by the way, Nancy, I know you got a long list of things to do, but can I have my Fourth Amendment back? And she looked at me in this puzzled, what does he mean? What are you talking about? And then she just shook my hand with a big smile and said, it's great to see you, Peter. and so yeah. we need to light some fires, and we need to pressure those who call themselves progressives. Ron Wyden is, according to the people I talked to at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others who were working on the surveillance issues, he appears to be the new Russ Feingold, the senator who really gets these issues. And so,
how about this? Here's an idea. Now, Ron Paul has, I mean, these things are not alien issues to Republicans. There's plenty of Republicans who are probably, if not as you know, want to push so hard against the national security state as Ron Paul does, by the way, which is something that drives Republicans crazy when he denounces imperialism and war. And I love it when he does it.
Me too.
I've been in the audience at a bunch of Republican gatherings where he does this, and about half of the audience is just seething.
Right.
They're so mad.
Yeah.
They're so mad. But that's the moments when I want to get up and cheer, you know. But there's got to be other Republicans. I mean, they love the Constitution, I mean, in an almost worshipful way. There's got to be – I've been thinking, if Romney and Ryan were to outflank Obama on the left on just one or two things.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and we've been having these close elections in this country for years and years and years. I remember back when Bob Dole was running against Clinton, and I was very unhappy about Clinton. That was in 96.
Sure.
And I had a soft spot in my heart for Bob Dole because he was a senator from Kansas. He'd been a good guy in the past.
He had a sense of humor before he ran for president, and they took it away
from
him.
That's right. And he had – not only that, but because he was so old, he had, as a matter of sheer age, voted for all kinds of very liberal things
right.
in the course of his career, you
yeah.
know?
Uh-huh.
Things that once upon a time he must have believed in. It's like, why not pull some of those out right now and outflank the Democrat on the left on certain things? This is a guy – Clinton is a guy that a lot of liberals were really uncomfortable with,
mm-hmm.
didn't like him. Where, you know, it just give those liberals some reason to vote for it. Throw them a bone, give them something, and see what happens. You could just, you know, throw this whole all these close elections every time it's the same issues. At least throw the thing for a loop. And but of course he never did that.
Well, and just
never
to...
have. Creativity to do that.
Just to follow your idea, Tom.
Obama has done all those things that you've described. Perfect opportunity for someone who says they love the Constitution, for someone who says they really believe in our rights as citizens,
mm-hmm.
for them to outflank him and appeal to people like you and me, and maybe contest those contest him, in a certain way. But the Republicans never have the imagination to do something like that. I would love to see it happen. Wouldn't that be something?
I think the most obvious issue
– I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Well, based on the polls, the clearest issue that Romney could use to create that leftist position to Obama's left would be to call for an immediate withdrawal from Afghanistan. That polls at the 60-65% level. And
yeah.
and yet we know that the Republicans
He'll
won't
never
touch
do
that.
Yeah, that's going too far.
That's bad for war profiteering. We can't.
But if you look at the two men's record on the issues, Obama or Romney is to the left of Obama on gun control. When
mm-hmm.
he was governor of Massachusetts, he passed very strict gun control laws.
Right.
But he didn't want to talk about that now.
Well, maybe he'll do a photo op duck hunt with Dick Cheney. You know.
Yeah. Or you just wish that they would get, you know, that they would apply some of this, you know, they all this tactical thinking that they dream up sitting around their mahogany tables here in Washington D.C. and they never think of doing something like that, you know, of doing something that's just a little bit innovative and you know, somehow turning the whole election upside down.
Well, their idea was Sarah Palin.
it's just like go for the long bomb in the culture wars, you know.
Yeah.
The Hail Mary pass.
Well, Tom, it's always a pleasure to talk with you. I would like to give you the final word. What would you like to add as a coda here?
When I say, you know, all this stuff that I'm saying about Republicans outflanking the Democrats on the left, of course it's never going to happen. But in the minds of a lot of people, they've already done that. I don't mean they've outflanked them on the left. They've put themselves across as a protest movement for hard times. They're the people that are standing up with the answers. Was it Fortune magazine or Forbes magazine that ran a cover with Paul Ryan as Franklin Roosevelt with the hat, the fedora, the cigarette holder, the jaunty grin? They basically morphed his face, what do you call it, photoshopped his face right onto a old picture of Franklin Roosevelt. And that's what the Tea Party movement is all about, you know, and that's what the choice of Paul Ryan is all about. And so Obama thinks he's got people like you and me in the bag and it doesn't matter. And he's probably right. But there's a lot of people out there who are suffering in areas with a lot of high unemployment. And these guys come across as the ones who are really willing to shake up Washington, really willing to shake up the system. Mm-hmm. And it's a shame they want to shake it up in the sense they want to get back to the 19th century. But at least they are, you know, they sound and they act like radicals from the 1930s. And that's fascinating.
Well, and the about face that, you know, Paul Ryan, the guy who does want to dismantle Medicare as it's currently structured, is now out on the stump saying he's there to protect Medicare from
That's
Obama's
right.
$700 billion right. Obamacare theft.
They're flipping the script on Obama. This is, of course, how Democrats have attacked Republicans since time immemorial, and they're flipping it on him. And, you know, whatever, that's going to happen. You know, you move to the center constantly, they're going to do that to you, you know?
Yeah. Well, Tom, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks for joining me on Skype today, and we'll look for your next column, and I'll take an antidepressant before I read it.
Anytime, Peter B.
Thomas Frank, Easy Chair columnist at Harper's Magazine, here on the Peter B. Collins Show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the official film reviewer of the Peter B. Collins Show, Mr. Gary Chu of Sacramento, California, weighs in on Will Ferrell's new political satire flick, The Campaign.
How could a super jerk incumbent candidate lose running on a platform of America, Jesus, and freedom? That's the ticket Cam Brady looks to have sewn up in another unopposed run for his U.S. House seat from North Carolina. But wait, isn't that the prissy tourist business guy, Marty Huggins, who just threw his hat in the ring to run against Cam? Cam is played by Will Ferrell, and Marty is played by Zach Galifianakis, which is an awful lot of syllables. Anyway, this timely vulgar movie called The Campaign is now playing in theaters all across this great nation of ours, and not a minute too soon, my fellow Americans. Chris Hinchey's script doesn't merely suggest, but rather gets right in your face about how disgusted most Americans are now about U.S. government and the absurdity of our current sputtering political system. That disgust is what stokes the laughter when seeing The Campaign. It's directed by that Austin Powers guy, Jay Roach. Not only does Jesus seem to be in both fictitious candidates' platforms, but he is also referred to as an American in some of the loopy rhetoric occasioning the stump speeches of Cam and Marty. What might offend some is, from the screenplay's point of view, the given in The Campaign is many Americans don't have the sense God gave a goose. Thankfully, and unfortunately, that's the reason the film is timely, even if it is El Rancho Grande in the blue language department. The crap cow's character pulls is really difficult to suspend your disbelief about. That's probably why Ferrell plays him and why it works so well. Same for Galifianakis, but Zach gives much the same shape to his Marty character that Jack Black does to his Bernie role in the current well-received movie of the same name. Both characters in either film call for each actor to be precious in demeanor, exuding gay body language, most significantly when speaking and walking. Shtick for gayness in films and on TV is rampant. And doesn't that blend well with the timeliness of the same-sex marriage issue jumping the tracks at Chick-fil-A and heading into the presidential election? Two older, just as familiar faces play the Motch brothers. They're Dan Aykroyd and John Lithgow. The Motch brothers are manipulating billionaires buying the election courtesy of the Citizens United decision. My sense of Aykroyd and Lithgow doing these parts is these guys were having a ball. Dylan McDermott as Tom is the mendacious, big-money, black-suited Motch Brothers guy. He takes over Marty's life to get Huggins into the appropriately framed phony lifestyle that's sure to bring up the challenger's numbers with the one-channel media masses. Jason Sudeikis, another Saturday Night Live favorite, plays Mitch. He's Tim's counterpart for Cam's campaign. It turns out that Mitch isn't such a terrible person or campaign manager after all. Some cable TV talk show personalities show up briefly as themselves. Chris Matthews, Ed Schultz, Piers Morgan, Wolf Blitzer, Lawrence O'Donnell, as well as the hosts of MSNBC's Morning Joe get to do their number. No one from mainline TV news is included, as well as any hosts or commentators from Fox Cable News. Political hate commercials are a focus of the campaign. One spot uses a video clip of Cal seducing Marty's wife. The seduction is payback to Marty for getting Cal taken in on a DUI after Cam stops by Marty's house. And Marty serves up some really potent and aged bourbon for Brady. As soon as Cal staggers from Marty's front door and speeds off in his garish campaign car, Marty calls the cops. Farrell and Yalia Fanakis play as Southerners. Farrell sometimes slips into a pronunciation pattern that prompted me to recall how former Senator John Edwards speaks. A running gag in the campaign is seeing the surprising identity of a woman who plays a house servant in the movie. You first hear her speak without seeing her. At the close of the film, you hear another woman's voice off camera and discover that she is also the same woman who surprised you in the earlier scene. The actor's name is Karen Maruyama, a Japanese-American who had a small part in Pulp Fiction. The accents Maruyama intones are first the dialect of an Afro-American woman, then later that of a Latina. Such humor has the same effect as the famous Groucho Marx quip, "I don't want to belong to any club that would have me as a member." Wouldn't it be fun to be a fly on the wall of a D.C. movie theater and all the U.S. Congress were there at a mandatory attendance screening of this film? I wonder who'd be laughing most, or maybe even if there would be any laughter. Heavens, there could ensue a filibuster in the section of the movie house where the senators are seated. I'm Gary Chu, seated over and down in the valley.
Well, it was right at this point that I had hoped to insert Will Durst's scintillating commentary about the selection of Paul Ryan as the vice presidential nominee to run with Bishop Mitt Romney. But the audio file isn't here yet.
Excuse me.
All right, we'll get you some Will Durst, hopefully on our next episode here at peterbcollins.com. Thanks a lot for listening.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then.